No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show that will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Or you can Skype us at BBSRADIOONE. We have no guests this week. Maria had a brilliant idea for a guest, but unfortunately we weren't able to line this person up. Maybe we'll get them sometime in the future. So tonight you got me and Maria, and we're going to discuss about what's going on in the world, and that should be fun, I think, because there's a lot going on. Maria, are you there?
I am, Michael, and good evening to you, and welcome to our listeners, and thank you for taking the time to find us in your busy schedules.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'm in San Diego taking care of my elderly parents, and my cousin and her husband came to visit. They are from Vienna, Virginia.
Oh, and, right around the corner.
Yeah, and so they were fascinated to hear about our program, and they're going to become loyal listeners, and they are inclined, as you are politically, Michael, Senator.
Oh, good so, people then, yeah.
Yes, and so it's always fun with family because my mother is a flaming right-winger. I was as far left as you can go and still have an R behind your name. So he was a lobbyist. He just retired, and she worked for TRW, and they've been in the District of Columbia for almost 40 years. So I wonder if you guys won't bump into each other at some point, but they've invited me to come out, and it was like, oh, then that means Michael and I could be doing the program live face to face. So I might take them up on that.
And I could take you to lunch in the Senate dining room,
that
which
would
is
be
always
awesome.
Fun.
That would be awesome.
And you know what? It's funny that you say all this, Maria, because I come from Kennett Square, Pennsylvania last week from my father-in-law's 85th mm-hmm. birthday party and saw more Trump signs. I think I've seen two Trump signs in Washington, D.C., but up in Kennett Square, they're very, very much a Republican area. There were many of them, so it was and they're very my father-in-law and my sister-in-law and brother-in-law are all Republicans. And it's funny because a lot of the people in my wife's family are also liberal Democrats. So that made for an interesting interaction. Even though a lot of wine and beer was consumed, no fights broke out, which
yay.
I was surprised at.
Yay,
yeah.
Yay.
But,
because we got it finally coming down tomorrow, Monday, September 26th, 9 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time, 6 o'clock Pacific Daylight Time, at Hofstra University in New York's Long Island, the first of three with the presidential debates. And I don't know if you want to go into NBC's Lester Holt, the nightly news anchor. I didn't realize he's only 57 years old, and people are calling him African-American.
Well, wasn't he African-American?
I didn't realize that, because all the pictures I see, I mean, I look at people to kind of make a broad brush stroke, and looking at him, he didn't appear that way to me, but... So I like it that he already anchored with Andrea Mitchell earlier this year, the Democrat primary debate, and they say he's got some big shoes to fill and that this could be huge for his career because they're expecting now the moderators to also be quasi fact checkers and to repudiate a statement that they feel is inaccurate or incorrect, which I think is a lot of responsibility to put on somebody on the fly.
Well, I think so, too. And you know, I really don't understand that, given the fact that this stuff will be dissected, the day after the fact.
Right. Of course.
It will, and any mistake will be lauded by the other side for a long time. And, you know, that's the first thing we teach people at campaign school. When, you know, I've taught campaign school a couple of times, and the first thing we say to candidates is, look, man, if you've got anything out there, if you cheated on a test when you were in high school, get it out there, because the world of fact checking has changed so dramatically that, I mean, if you have a ticket or you have whatever you've done in your life is out there somewhere, and people will find out about it. So you need to stand up and get out in front of it, and not just leave it out there. So,
I know that's got to be dicey, because I've been attended campaign management school myself, and then I've run campaigns, and that is always, you know, let us know what it is that we need to vet so we can decide whether or not it's a deal breaker. But I'm sure people go, oh, well, that happened 25 years ago. Do I really need to? But do you remember Tim Allen, who was the television star of the program?
Sure.
Okay, he did exactly that. He got arrested and served time for something with cocaine.
I remember.
And he put that out before any of his fame, and it never ended up causing him any problem, because he's like, I didn't have anything to hide. You guys knew that at the time. Yeah. And I thought that's the best example that I could share with you about the point that you're making is, and I guess Trump must have been pretty faithful to his wives, because you know, if he's going to call out different things, i.e. Jennifer Flowers, et cetera, he had better watch what he says.
Well, how can you not be faithful when you've had three wives?
Well,
I mean, you know,
if you swing from wife one to two.
Wait a second. You just replace them when you get tired of them.
Let's say you were cheating on wife one with wife two, i.e. Marla Maples. I don't know the succession, how that happened, but that's how that can happen. How many times have we seen men cheat and then they marry the ultimate woman, but initially they were cheating? So I'm not suggesting that he did. I'm just saying I sure hope he didn't, only because he's been raising that with Hillary's husband.
I know. And, you know, the thing that annoys me about it is I don't know why women aren't more upset that she is being that this guy wants to bring in crimes of her husband. I mean, what did Hillary Clinton do to be a co-conspirator with her husband on sleeping with Jennifer Flowers or whoever else he slept with? The young woman whose name escapes me now, who was Monica Lewinsky. Thank you. Or any of those people. What did she have to do with any of that? Nobody.
Well, Michael, the only thing you could say is that when she called it a right-wing conspiracy before it all got vetted, she was suggesting that it was people making up lies on the right to cast aspersion against her husband's character.
Well, I mean, standing up for your husband is not I don't think is a sin in America.
No.
And, you know, I think the biggest mistake she made is when she trashed one of America's sweethearts by saying that I'm not a stand by your man kind of gal, which I'm not sure was true to begin with. But you don't make fun of one of the best loved country singers in American history. So, that was a mistake, and she's made a few mistakes lately. I think that people are talking about this Mark Cuban thing that she's bringing him. So he wants to bring the people that her husband slept with. I don't even see the comparison there. Mark Cuban's a businessman, you know, and I think that we've got every reason to believe that there's a problem with Donald Trump's business acumen, because he won't release his tax returns. He won't let people see where his money comes from and where it goes. And we just learned this week, and I don't know why things don't stick to him, but they don't. You know, they used to who is the Teflon Don, the guy in New York City? Nothing ever stuck to him. Maybe it's a New Yorker thing. But, you know, this man gave $250,000 of his charitable foundation money went to pay his debts. And nobody's making a big deal about it.
I think when push comes,
go ahead.
I think when it all comes down to it, because there was just a poll that was released this weekend, which was the Washington Post, ABC News, and they show it. They call it a horse race. 46%
right.
likely voters Clinton, 44% Trump. But here's the difference: 17% of registered voters are still undecided. That's they're going to make the decision for us. Those 17%.
Well, and you know what? Isn't that the point that this young man that we had on the show last week was making? We're spending $2.2 billion to influence that 17% of the population because everybody else has already made up their mind anyway. So, right. You know, you've got 83% of the population who's decided what they're going to do, and we're spending all this money to just to influence the 17%. But you're right. Those are the people that will make up the difference. And I think that it's stunning. I saw that there was a survey done, and I'm sorry, I can't remember who the people were, but they said there's a new survey that's out on the, you know, they're touting on the internet where they've surveyed millennials who are willing to give up some of their democratic rights for security. Or say, and it's
really?
The first time in American history, yeah, that people are saying, well, you know, if I have to give up the right to privacy to be safe, I'm willing to do that. That seems so contrary to, you know, the way we live here in America, where our personal freedom and our personal liberty and our personal privacy is so important to us. But, you know, of course, these guys are growing up under different times. I don't think I ever felt unsafe growing up in America. You know,
true.
I lived in Newark, New Jersey. And, you know, and from day one, I was sat down and people would say things to, you know, like, don't go into this neighborhood. Don't walk down an alley alone at night. Don't, you know, you live in a dangerous city. I mean, we're always aware of that. But I don't think we felt unsafe because of the random violence. You know,
I was just going to say, I think it's the randomness that is what is pervasive for folks, because you could be anybody anywhere and it doesn't seem to have a rhyme or a reason, which is one. I used to go to Mexico 2 to 3 times a year. And then when the randomness of the drug started happening with the cartels, that's when I stopped going. And I'm normally not that kind of a person, but there was a mother that was killed on purpose, but for no reason. And that's when I thought, they've got my attention. That you can't do anything about. It's not being in the wrong place at the wrong time or being in a bad neighborhood or staying at a shoddy hotel or something like that. That was total and pure innocence. Now, I've since resumed going back to Mexico, so I'm not afraid of that anymore. And being in Southern California, I usually drive there now. And they're like, wow. And I was like, I've never, ever, ever had a problem. And I've probably driven there, I don't know, 12 times in the last year and a half.
Well, I got to tell you, I remember the days when they were having all the drug problems. And it really astounded me because I spent some real time in Mexico, loved Mexico, love the Mexican people.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a teenager, I drove from Phoenix, Arizona down to Guatemala, and that was a long time
wow.
ago. The roads really – yeah, my favorite thing about the trip, and I just have to add this, is they were building a national highway at the time, and you go down like 200 miles of gravel road. And
you finally
come to a paved road. And you get up on the paved road for like 100 yards and there would be a toll booth and you pay the toll and you go through the toll booth. Then you get back on the gravel road. You know, it was hysterical. But
brief interruption of asphalt, there is a price that you must pay.
Yeah. And, you know, and I remember that we used to at night, we would only drive behind the buses because in the mountains and stuff, I was with a couple of friends, they let cattle roam around on the roads and stuff. And we were afraid to be out there except behind the buses. But the people were wonderful to us. And then I remember, you know, being just shocked when people would say, well, we're going to go to southern Mexico, but, you know, there's so many problems down there. And I'd be like, what do you mean? And yeah. So, I remember that time, too. And the randomness, I think, really, really bothers people because we always want a reason. You know, that's who we are.
And we try to make sense out of nonsense sometimes, which I know I do because I'm a logical person. I'm more left brain than most women. And it's like, wait a second, this isn't making sense. Let's make sense out of it. And sometimes my friends are like, Maria, sometimes it doesn't make sense. Like, yeah, you can't always do it. But I wanted to mention, Michael, that the title of the tomorrow's debate is America's Direction, Achieving Prosperity and Securing America, which means pretty much that he can ask anything, if you will. But it also seems to be paying into, and it'll be interesting to see, they say that Hillary's message is more optimistic and Donald's Make America Great Again, not as much. What is your take on that, as in America's Direction, Achieving Prosperity specifically?
Well, you know, if it was my call to make on advising these campaigns, I would say that the optimistic approach is the better approach. But, you know, again, you're dealing with a situation which is different than it's ever been before in terms of the economy and jobs. You know, I mean, I have a kid that and you have children that aren't much older than this, but I have a kid right out of college who doesn't expect to find a job. That just blows me away, because when I went through college, we just assumed, you know, that on the way home from the graduation ceremony, someone would walk up to me and say, "Hey, Michael, I got this great job for you."
And you know, they had career fairs.
Right.
I don't know about you on the East Coast, but in California, our, like last quarter, I attended a quarter system with the UC system. They had career fairs, and we often got job offers while we were right prior to graduation. They were coming to recruit.
I know the University of California is pretty liberal, but my college, what we used to do, and this amazes me, on the first day of school, they used to pull beer trucks onto the campus and give everybody free beer. So 2 o'clock, every student was drunk.
No, they did.
Yeah, they actually did. Yeah, and people would give you business cards. You'd go get your free beer, and they give you a business card, and they would say, "Look, if you need a cake for a dorm party or something, here's my card." And they were actually representatives that were students, usually, that represented, you know, Miller and Budweiser and et cetera, et cetera. But no, we had the same type of thing, and we went through the want ads. I mean, my first job out of college was a terrible job. I worked for a law firm, and they didn't pay me much, and they worked my rear end off, and, you know, but it was a professional job, and I found it in a newspaper. Mm-hmm. I didn't have any connections. I didn't have, you know, and that led to a career.
Some of our younger listeners, it must sound archaic to think, because of course now everything's electronic and Monster and Glassdoor and all that stuff. Because I've got my eldest son, who graduated from the University of Southern California, he floundered. He graduated from the Marshall School of Business, which is like the one or two top in the country in entrepreneurial studies. And he kept getting hired by startups who were underfunded. He'd be working 60, 70 hours a week, and then he'd be one of the first to go because he was the last in because they were finally trying to diversify. He now, fortunately, has a career, but now my second son, he's a graduate from UC Davis, and he graduated in managerial economics, which was a newer kind of thing, and he's got his second or third interview tomorrow with another company because he's shifting careers. So, yeah, my kids are still in the middle of it, some of them, with their degrees.
And I think this has changed the paradigm for people. So so obviously the most important thing is jobs and the future of the economy in America.
Which would fall under the achieving prosperity part.
Right. But it's also a political, you know, this is the oldest political thing in the book. I won't call it a trick, but I'll just say the oldest political ploy in the book, or the oldest strategy in the book, is during bad times to not be positive. You know, I mean, we look at all the politicians that have risen to power during bad times, and a lot of them were out there with a negative message.
Well, here's the
I don't know that it won't be, you know, how effective it'll be.
It's going to be tough.
I think Americans, though, basically are optimists. So I think I would advise an optimistic message.
But. I do, too. But the problem is with optimism, which I'm always a glass half full person. But the problem with optimism in Trump's case is if you're happy with the status quo, why would you want change? Because in my estimation, I think most people see Hillary Clinton as more of the same. So that's the line that he has to draw, is that, okay, are we better off than we were? If not, what's wrong and how can we do that? Well, that would be change with him. By the way, he was concerned that it was going to, Trump was, that the debate being on a Monday was going to compete with Monday Night Football, which is only being broadcast on ESPN, and it's the Saints versus the Falcons. And everyone's going, no, I don't think so. It's probably not going to be a problem. Because apparently everybody is going to be streaming it tomorrow. Everybody.
Yeah,
every television, every cable. They said Twitter, and what, there's a new app out called Hillary Donald. And you can either boo or cheer virtually on our phones by shaking or tapping the phones. And then they're going to spread that into charts and maps and stuff. And that's going to be in real time for tomorrow's debate. So, I mean, the technology is just getting more and more complex and sophisticated. And we'll get to see what people think if they download something like that.
Well, it's certainly... it certainly is changing quickly. And you know, I've got to say that right from the very beginning, I've had a problem with this slogan, Make America Great Again, because I don't remember a time when America wasn't great. And around the world, we're still seen as being great. But you know what? It's selling. People are listening to that. And that's the thing about politics. You have to listen to what people are saying. That's our political system. Even if they're saying things you don't like, this is really how our system works, right? That you know, that's why we have a voice in our system. And I think that this is a mistake that they're both making. And I think Donald Trump's making more of a mistake than Clinton is, but I think they're both playing to their crowds. And as you said, we're going after the 17%, you know, for Donald Trump to stand up and just talk. He's talking to the people that support him, and Hillary Clinton is talking to the people that support her. And I think they need to start talking to that 17%.
Which those are registered voters, meaning not folks
right.
that still have time, because on Tuesday of this week is National Voter Registration Day. So there's all kinds of opportunities to get people able to register to vote. So if that is any kind of success, then that means that there will be more than 17%, because there will be more registered voters after Tuesday.
Well, and the thing. Is as far as that goes, I think that Hillary has an advantage.
Yes.
So I'm sure they'll be out there, because more people are Democrats than Republicans when they register, although independents are growing significantly. And Donald Trump, one of the problems that he has is he really doesn't have a ground game. And she's
yep.
got a big ground game. So that's going to be a big, you know, that may defy the polls. But let me tell you that this is a very interesting fact that you probably haven't heard in California, but there's a guy at American University who's predicted every presidential race since 1984. He's predicted accurately, picked the winner in every race in 30 years, more than 30 years. And he says by his system, he has a 10-point system where he rates these 10 different things. He said by that system, Trump should win if his system is correct.
But totally surprised me with that.
Yeah, and he said...
So because that's not Electoral College, though. It's 10 facets that he says contributes to somebody winning.
Right, like are people, whether you have the incumbency or not, if mm-hmm. you have the... This is one factor that I remember. If your party is the incumbent party, okay, mm-hmm. and the economy is viewed as not doing well, then that's one of the factors that you're more likely to get the party that's out of power, for example. Mm-hmm. So that's one of his factors. And you know, in his estimation of the way people feel about the economy is that's one he would put in Trump's column, for example. And he says that if you get seven of these things, you win. And Trump's got six of them. And he thinks that you know, he may... I forget what the seventh one is, but it's kind of a toss-up at this point, but it's a toss-up leaning towards Trump. So, but then he adds that Trump may change everything. He may change everything because he's not playing by the same rules as everybody else has played by in the past. So that may change the paradigm. So, you know, I don't know whether that's his real opinion or he's just covering his ass if, you know, in case he's not right. But,
well, they're saying, you know, if somebody makes a real gaffe or if somebody makes an obvious overstatement or something, that could be a deal breaker. And who's more likely to do that, measured Hillary Clinton or volatile Donald Trump?
Yeah. Well, and you know what? You've got to admit, this is going to be one for the record books anyway. When is the last time that we've had a man or a woman run for the office of President of the United States that has absolutely no political experience? Mm-hmm. I mean, that we've had people like Ross Perot, okay, and we certainly have had people like Ralph Nader, but we've never had anybody that was the candidate of a major political party. That, you know, one of the two major political parties that had no experience in politics.
Well, you're elected politics, because there's politics in everything, even in religion, as you know.
Yep.
So he's had to navigate for decades through politics, but not by being elected and being held accountable to the office of which he was elected.
Yeah, and we've all, you know that, you've been involved in politics. We all have personal politics, and maybe the worst politics is office politics. It may be the most treacherous, and we all have to deal with it. But there's something to be said for elected office and how, you know, in terms of experience and knowing, not only knowing what you're doing, but knowing how to get there, right? Because there's a steep learning curve. And this guy has violated many of the rules that we put up, you know, as I guess that I've just been amazed because he's done many things, not that Hillary Clinton hasn't done a few herself, but he's done many things that if he were in my campaign school, I'd be saying, no, mm-hmm. you can't do that. You can't say that a veteran, a distinguished veteran, you don't like a distinguished veteran? No, you can't do that. You can't say these things about women. You can't say these things about minorities. But he's done it, and it doesn't seem to affect his popularity. That, I just think, is amazing. And I don't know what that says about how the politics of America is changing. But the politics of America are changing. They really are.
And, well, our world is changing.
Yeah,
I think that's part of it, Michael, is, yes, this is unlike anything we've ever seen, i.e. one, a woman candidate for a major party, i.e. two, a non-elected official person getting to be where Donald Trump is. But everything, I mean, I hate to sound old-fashioned, but I sometimes like to harken back to when things were simpler. And I was saying to my mother, you know, remember that we survived lead paint and that we survived riding bicycles without helmets on and that we didn't come home till the street lights went on and we didn't have cell phones. And somehow we made it, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
But that has all changed now.
Right. Well, I said,
completely and totally.
One of my kids said something to me one day, said, well, you didn't have seatbelts. And I said, no, we had seatbelts. We just used to stuff them down in the
seat. Exactly. We didn't wear them.
No one ever wore a seatbelt.
Never.
They were just something that, you know, that's like the thing you did on the first day you got the car. Yes, yeah, stuff the seatbelt into the seat. And sit up front at, you know, on your way to the drive-in, have five kids in the front seat with your dad on those big bench seats, you know? And my favorite was we had one of those station wagons with the rear-facing seat.
Yes.
You know, and we fought like hell to be in the rear-facing seat. That was a cool place to be. Mm-hmm. Think of all the rear-end collisions in the world and, you know, whose great idea it was to put your kids at the very back of the car. But, you know, but you're right. We survived all that stuff.
Somehow.
We survived. But I think tomorrow's going to be a real turning point, I've got to tell you.
I agree with you.
And if I had to debate somebody, I would want Donald Trump. If I could pick anybody in the world, because of the way he fights, he's got a very thin skin, and that's the guy you want in a debate. Remember that I guess the most famous debate story is Richard Nixon and Kennedy, where everybody said that if you listen to the debate on radio, Nixon won, but on TV, Kennedy won. And he walked away with it because Nixon looked pensive and he sweat a lot. And, you know, it's amazing to think that these little things have such impact, but they do. And it was the first televised debate. So,
And it's 5 o'clock shadow and
right.
Kennedy
was the tall, handsome guy.
Yes.
And Nixon was kind of the little, you know, not, you know, he wasn't, you know, I don't think anybody ever accused him of being handsome, but that perception will play a big role.
So in between this debate and we have a broadcast before him, so we can go into it more, is on Tuesday, October 4th, is the vice presidential debate at Longwood University, which is in Virginia, which, by the way, Tim Kaine, former governor of Virginia, so they're saying right. That's kind of his home court advantage. And then we have, again, October 9th at Washington University in St. Louis, another presidential debate. So it's coming upon us fast and furious, Michael.
Yeah, it really is. And you know as far as the vice presidential debate, I think you have two guys. Tim Kaine is very well spoken, very measured, very seasoned politician, and just a guy that I've met several times that I happen to like a lot. But I think with him and Pence, you have opposite sides of the same coin. You know, I think that I don't think anything dramatic will happen in that debate, as they are both well-seasoned politicians and know what they're doing, and they're both kind of middle-of-the-road guys. They're not, you know, neither one of them is. It's funny that I think that they both picked the same kind of guy, the same kind of person, from their party. And you know, and I think that I talked to you about this earlier before we got on the air, is that I think this is one of the mistakes that Hillary has made, is that she's allowing her opposition to a certain extent to dictate her strategy. The thing that she said about his supporters, about Trump's supporters, that was a political mistake. And you know, he had been a name caller and she had been above it. Now she's a name caller too. And you know, you never let the person you're running against tell you how to run your campaign.
Yeah. It's
easy to do. You see, you know, somebody doing something and they're getting ahead, then you want to do it too. But I always think it's a mistake.
Michael, I wanted to ask you too. I'm sorry. Did I interrupt you?
No, go ahead.
Okay. Because I'm from Los Angeles, we have to talk about Vin Scully. But I wanted to ask what you know. I hear nothing but amazing buzz about the Smithsonian's new African American Culture and History Museum that opened yesterday.
Well, guess who was there at the opening?
I was wondering, were you
yes,
really?
Yes, I was.
Tell us about it. They say the artifacts, the architecture, the layout. It's just stunning.
First of all, what's gone viral on the internet is Michelle Obama hugging George Bush. Have you seen this?
No.
She walks in and she hugs Bush in like
43?
Yeah, okay. No, Bush
41,
43, right?
Okay,
and she hugs him. The reason let me first say that Bush and Obama were there because Bush was the guy that authorized the museum and the money for the museum originally and did the authorization for the museum. And of course, Obama was the president while it was being built, but George Bush played a prominent role in getting the museum started. It was started by an act of Congress, but of course, President Bush signed it into law and made funding available and insisted, much to his credit, that the museum be on the National Mall. Mm-hmm. He didn't want it. You know, there was evidently a debate at the time of where exactly they were going to put it in Washington. And you know, the Native American Museum is on the Mall and all the important museums are on the Mall. And Bush insisted it be on the Mall. And maybe that's the most beautiful thing about it, is that it's at the corner of 14th and Constitution Avenue, which at one time was the slave market in Washington, D.C. So it's built on the grounds of what was the slave market. But it was an amazing opening.
And also underground, I hear.
Under the landfill. Some of it is underground. And it's supposed to be amazing. Now, we didn't get a tour of it because the ceremony was going on yesterday. So what happens is, you know, you had President Obama there, you had President Bush, you had the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, you had Paul Ryan, you had lots of other speakers and celebrities, Oprah Winfrey and Will Smith, Robert De Niro, and I can't remember all the people that were there.
Well, Oprah gave $21 million to have that Oprah Winfrey Theater, which is, I mean, talk about a gift, huh?
Yeah.
Even though it took much, much more than that. But still, her name is on it.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I mean, you can come, let me tell you, you can come speak at the opening of the Michael Brown Museum if you give $21 million. I don't care who the hell you are. But yeah, and it was great, and it was very uplifting. You know, I think I saw a lot of African Americans that didn't ever think it would happen. I think I could just see it in people's eyes that they were just so impressed that this day had finally come, and it really was the highlight of my week. And I've talked to many, many people. I've been busy over the last 2 weeks with a statehood initiative that's coming up on our ballot, and I'm going to talk for a second about. I'm actually in a debate at Constitution Hall in Washington that's being pushed by Ralph Nader. And it's going to be a pretty big event, I think, because Constitution Hall probably holds 4,000 or 5,000 people. So
when is this?
It's on Wednesday of this week.
Okay.
And he's very much pushing it. So we'll see. We'll see how many people show up. But I've been tied up with things like that. But every person that I talked to that went to the museum said it was amazing. And the night before the opening, our building, my office is in City Hall, and it's about a block and a half from where the museum is. So we had a big thing the night before the opening. We had a reception at our building, and, you know, people who had been to the museum got up and spoke, and every one of them just says it's amazing. It's amazing. Well, you have amazing.
NPR interviewed the architecture, so I heard that, and he took the reporter or anchor, what have you, on a tour. So visually, I felt like I had been there. But for our listeners, they say that the tickets are free, that they're timed. You can get up to 6 tickets at a time. You have to go onto the website or call an 800 number, and that they're going to go out obviously quickly because this is the must-see thing. So I just have to add that to my list of to-do when I come visit you in D.C.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? They're saying already that the time tickets have been given out for the whole month of October.
I know they hadn't closed through the year, so they were saying you're just not going to get them anytime soon.
But it's a hot ticket right now.
Yeah, I have a girlfriend who lives in Capitol Hill, and I was visiting with her. It was in 2009, and she said, I'm going to get us tickets to the Holocaust Museum. You know, we're going to spend a couple hours there. And I thought, oh, my God, a couple of hours. I can't imagine what misery that's going to be just with all this pain and suffering. We got there at 10 in the morning. They kicked us out at 5:30. I would have been there longer. Yeah. I was lingering over everything, how powerful it was and, you know, how sad and tragic and you know, whatever. So I can only imagine that this must be something in its emotional impact as well.
Well, I think yes, but I think the difference you'll find. Now, I worked as a consultant on the opening of the Holocaust Museum, and it is, it's just extremely moving, like you said, but it's so sad. Some of the things, like when you go into the room full of shoes and you just see the shoes, I don't know if you remember that, but thousands of pairs of shoes, you know, and you just think to yourself, all these people lost. But the thing about this museum, in addition to slavery, they've got Chuck Berry. They've got, you know, they've got Muhammad Ali.
And the violin.
Yeah, they have, they have Louis Armstrong's trumpet. They have, you know, so they have, and that's actually the name of the museum is the National Museum of African American Heritage and Culture.
History
and Culture, yes. Yeah. And so so there's a lot of the culture of African Americans is celebrated there. And, you know, in Washington, it's so great that we have it here because not only did African Americans, many of whom were slaves at the time, build Washington, D.C., but so much during the Civil Rights Movement, and that's what John Roberts talked about, from Brown versus Board of Education to, you know, the I Have a Dream speech on the National Mall. So much of the Civil Rights Movement happened right there. So it's such an appropriate place to have it. And that was the... That was the good thing of the week for me. And I got to tell you, it was very moving. When George Bush gave his – Laura Bush gave a little speech and George Bush, people applauded for them just the way they applauded for Obama. Yeah. And it was nice
about
to
America.
See
yeah.
– Right. It was nice it's to bipartisan. See finally not, you know, people putting away their partisan bitterness and saying, yeah, thank you for what you did, President Bush. You know, 90% of those people were Democrats, I guarantee you. But, you know, they appreciated his input and what he had done. And, you know, I think that we need to see so much more of that in Washington. So it was the one really, really feel good thing of the week. And of course, everybody complained because it was such a massive undertaking. You know, there were, if I had to guess, I would say there were 3,000 people there and there wasn't an empty seat. And you all had to first get screened.
Of course.
And get a ticket. What they did was they gave you wristbands, you know, like when you go into a bar and, you know, to prove you're 21, they gave you wristbands with your seat on it. So, or the section that you're sitting in. And so you had to go through that process. Then you had to walk about 0.3 miles to the grounds of the place and then go through, of course, a security screening. Mm-hmm. And there was security everywhere. I mean, everywhere. And the one annoying thing, the one thing that annoyed me is that when the president was speaking, there was a helicopter flying overhead.
Oh, brother.
Yeah.
That's
and, you
bad.
Know, it's like, you know, that that's part of a security thing, you know, that these guys going around the mall, because it's big open
photographers.
Space. Well, maybe photographers, but you know, it's annoying. You're trying to listen and you're hearing this. But anyway,
well, I'm glad that
you
were there, because it opened to the public today at 1 o'clock your time, and amid the 3 days celebration, and this is another bright star in our flag of the United States of America.
Yeah.
And I just hear the part about the underground part, that they do that deliberately, that you start in darkness and then you ascend into lightness as it goes through the markers in the history of our culture and the race and what have you. And so there's so many metaphors that are in that, that I guess you might not know that if you didn't realize what was happening. So I just, I'm really looking forward to being able to be a part of being a spectator there.
Well,
so can
know,
I just give a little Vin Scully a plug, please?
Yeah, please. Go ahead.
So he's announcing today is his last Dodger home game of his 67-year career. And
he's
then
been
his
a broadcaster for 67 years?
67 years.
Wow.
He started at age 22 with the Brooklyn Dodgers.
Wow.
And they brought him west. And then his last broadcast is going to be on October 2nd when the Dodgers play the Giants in San Francisco. And he decided not to do the playoffs. He said that I'm done with the regular season. And apparently grown men have been crying at Dodger Stadium on Friday and again today. The batters, as they were going to the batting box today, each one of them took off their batting helmets and waved it towards him. And he started to get the picture that they were like saluting him. He choked up. I mean, it's just been something. So obviously the man has been blessed with wellness and abundance and talent and longevity, but to be able to go out on his terms, they're calling him probably the world's greatest broadcaster, if not sports broadcaster. I mean, think about that, Michael. 67 years doing anything.
Yeah. No, it's amazing. And I know how people feel, because when I was a kid, we had one of the greatest sports writers in the history of journalism. Maury Povich's dad, Shirley Povich, wrote for the Washington Post. And my dad used to sit there and read me his sports columns, you know. And they were just amazing. You know, it was like you were sitting in the front row. And when he retired, you know, we've had the same feeling here in Washington, because he did it. He didn't do it for 67 years. I've never heard anything like that, but he did it for 40 years plus. And it was a great loss. And I'm sure that's a great loss to the people of Southern California who root for the Dodgers.
What ended up happening is people used to listen to him, if you recall, on transistor radios.
Right.
And then they would go to the game and they would still listen to the transistor radios while they were watching the game live. And one time, apparently there's a rule that a pitcher has to wait a second before delivering the pitch.
Yeah.
And Vin Scully said to the listeners, I'm going to say A and you say B when you think a second has elapsed. So everybody at Dodger Stadium started saying B. And if you weren't listening to the radio, you didn't know what was happening. So somebody called the press box and said, why is everybody saying B? I think it was the owner of the team. And they explained, well, Vin Scully said that if I say A, you say B, and everyone dutifully followed along. So, those are anecdotal. It's not folklore. That actually did happen. But that's the kind of impact he had on the Dodgers. So it's just, what a career, what a man, what a legacy. Just like, wow.
And those good sportscasters, you know, they can bring a new, an additional dimension to the game. When I had my first apartment, somebody gave us a TV. It was a great TV. It was black and white, and it had no sound whatsoever. So the primary purpose of the television was to watch football games.
Uh-huh.
And we used to get together on Sundays and watch football games, because we would turn the radio on. Mm-hmm. And we would listen to Sonny Jurgensen and Sam Huff, which were two former Redskins. And we got so into this that years later, you know, when the same group would get together, we would turn off the sound on the TV mm-hmm. and turn on the radio because they were so good and they were also so partisan. You know, they right. would say, they would
the
say, yeah,
yeah,
the guy from the 49ers gained 16 yards on the carry. And then the next play would be, and Washington gained another 5 yards. He busted through the front line. And they would get real dramatic about mm-hmm. them. So we had more fun listening to them. And then it became kind of a superstition that in order to win the game, you had to have Sonny and Sam on the radio. So those people, you know, they bring so much to our lives.
Well, and I have to say that's the power of radio, because you are painting pictures for people
right.
with the stories that you tell them, that their imagination then informs and actually makes bigger. And that's one of the reasons I don't think radio will ever go away, because it's the perfect complement between the content and the listeners and the impact and what they do with the words that they hear. You don't have any control over how somebody creates it in their mind. You do have control over how their eyes see a product, but not about how their imagination takes over. And that's what I love about radio.
Well, and you know that I wonder how much we lose over the fact that we don't have as much of it anymore. You know, like my kids, I have two daughters that are both amazing dancers. One of them dances professionally, but I'll put on a Fred Astaire movie. I remember when they were younger, and they won't watch it because it's black and white.
Right. Yeah.
You know, how good could it be? And I'm saying to them, this man, this is a man that may be the most amazing dancer that ever lived. Not to mention Ginger Rogers, who did everything he did, but backwards
and in high heels.
Yeah. you know, I mean, it's just amazing. And they'll be like, yeah, that's an old movie. And I wonder how much of that we lose because we don't use our imaginations enough anymore.
Well before you're speaking to the woman that reads a newspaper every day. So
me too.
newspaper. Not an electronic
too.
One.
can't do that thing with my wife, the librarian, has a Kindle and she has an iPad and she
nope.
gets a lot of information. No, nope. I need to take it and fold it. I have a certain way of folding it. Mm-hmm. I have a certain order. I mean, I don't think I'm OCD, but I've got to read the horoscope last. And mm-hmm. I never make any important decisions in my life without reading my horoscope.
Are you?
Yes. And that's why I brought up last week that NASA was changing the dates of the signs. But
okay.
as it turns out, they're not going to do it.
Okay.
They're not
changing. I was wondering how they were going to pull that off.
Thank God for all this crazy people. But you know what? And we're going to have to leave this for another show. Two things. One was the mall shooting that happened in Washington State, where they found out that this guy, they've now caught him, was involved in several domestic assaults.
Yeah.
You know, and that's an issue that I know you and I want to talk about, how this with people, how this behavior at a younger age can be a predictor of this sort of thing.
Right.
I know, for example, that serial killers are very often, strangely enough, people that mistreat animals when they're
yes.
children. And how strange
and
that is.
And bedwetters and pyromaniacs. Those three, it's called the triangle.
Uh-oh, I'm a pyro. I'm the guy that puts too much lighter fluid on the grill, so I better watch out. And something else that we want to talk about in the next few weeks, I think, is they did a study at Harvard that showed that 3% of the population owns 50% of the guns in America. And that this 3% of the population has an average of 17 guns apiece. And I think that's an interesting fact, that only 3% of us own half of all the guns.
That is really telling.
Yeah, I think it is.
Wow.
I mean, I don't know what these people are they're preparing for. But, you know, and I'm one of those people that grew up around guns. You know, think that the Second Amendment is important. I don't like the way it's been interpreted by the court, but I think you do have a right to defend yourself. But that's just crazy. 50% of the guns owned by three people. So we'll have to talk about that in the next few weeks. Maria Sanchez, thank you so much for being here every week. We're out of time.
Have a great week, Michael. It's so great to have you on the other coast and do what you do. So stories that I read about, you're actually there. It's awesome.
Well, yeah. And my wife would say that, too. It'd be nice to have me on the opposite coast. But it's a little husband humor, honey, in case you're listening.
Yes.
But anyway, we'll see you next week, America.
Yes.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for your time, America.
Like the river I've been running ever since. It's been a long